This HedgeGhoul series of podcasts is brought to you by History Ireland Magazine and the Wardwell Group. For more information or to subscribe, visit historyireland.com. Well, hello, history lovers, and welcome to the latest History Ireland HedgeGhoul, one of a series we're doing on the War of Independence. And this is your HedgeGhoul master, Tommy Graham, editor of History Ireland magazine. Now, today we're looking at Cork, Crucible of the War of Independence, question mark. And we have on screen here, we're bringing you this to the wonders of Zoom. We've Andy Bielenberg, Eve Morrison, Pádraig Ó Ruaidhrigh, and Jerry White. And this HedgeGhoul is supported by the Commemorations Unit of the Department of Culture, Heritage and the Gaeltacht. But God knows what it's called now with the new government. I haven't checked yet on that. Now, Jerry, can I go to you first? Okay, we're looking at the War of Independence, but let's talk a little bit about the political background here. What was the political situation in Cork? And we're talking here about the city and the county. What happened in the 1918 general election, for example?
Well, okay, if I may, Tommy, just let me go back a very small bit. I think at the turn of the century, it would be fair to say that Cork was seen as a nationalist stronghold, but with a very strong separatist tradition that had gone back to the Fenians, and that was kept alive with organisations such as the Irish Republican Brotherhood, the Gaelic League, the Gaelic Association, Inéin Ina Héireann, the Women's Organisation, Maud Gonne's Organisation, the Celtic Literary Society, and indeed others. So not alone did they keep that separatist spirit alive, but they fostered it. Politically, the last, general election was December 1910, and that saw a return of seven members of the All-For Ireland League and one member of John Redmond's Irish Party. But the First World War, would actually change all that. It created the conditions for the Easter Rising, led to a split in the volunteer movement, created a conscription crisis of 1918. So I think and more importantly, in the context of Cork, it led to the deaths of over 4,200 men and probably twice as many wounded. So I think it's fair to say that by the end of the war, November 1918, the people of Ireland, and indeed the people of Cork, had had enough. All those people dead, not one iota of self-determination granted by the British government. And the Easter Rising had shown them that there was a new way, there was a different way. The rise of Sinn Féin offered them a new vision, an independent Irish Republic. And that manifested itself in the 1918 general election when Sinn Féin swept the board. And in Cork,
Harry, can I just bring in there on the 1916 Rising, because was it a matter of some embarrassment, like for Cork Republicans, that very little happened?
Well, absolutely.
In 1916,
they weren't prepared to take part, but a whole series of confusing and conflicting orders beforehand meant that the Cork Brigade had mobilised on Easter Sunday instead of Easter Monday, and by the time they got orders information that the Rising had taken place, there was nothing really they could do. So they were surrounded in the headquarters for a week, and they did negotiate an agreement with the Lord Mayor and the British military, whereupon they would hand up their weapons for safekeeping. But that was broken, and all the weapons was confiscated, and hundreds of prominent Republicans throughout the county were actually arrested, interned, and sent over to Britain.
They were arrested anyway. Yeah,
absolutely. That did weigh heavily on the minds of the leadership at the time.
Just going back to the First World War, Jerry, you gave figures there for the casualties, right?
Yeah.
Have we any idea what casualty were pro rata? In other words, because I know Cork was a big area of recruitment for the British Army. I mean, was its rate of casualties the same as everywhere else, or was it more or less, or do we know?
I'm not exactly 100% certain in that, but I know that, like I said, the casualty rate was excessively high. My own research has it at over 4,200. And for example, 125 Corkmen alone died at the Battle of Jutland. And this would have had a huge impact on the families they left behind. People would have been asking themselves, what was it all for? And Sinn Féin capitalised on this in the 1918 general election, in a campaign. This is what they were saying at the various public meetings around the city. They were quoting 60,000 dead, and for what? What did Britain give us? Nothing.
Now, just on that point, if you look at the fatalities in the First World War, it's important to point out that about half the fatalities in the county were in the city. So it had a particular impact on the city and its politics and so forth.
And that would be a working class element, Andy, wouldn't it?
I mean, absolutely, yeah. Like most of the recruits obviously came from the poorer areas of the city, but also the towns around the county, the working class areas in the towns, the lanes and so forth. So, yes, that was very important.
And it also meant, presumably, for amongst those who survived, that there were a lot of people around with military experience. This was proved crucial. You know, the Tom Barrys of this world were part of the First World War. Paul, you want to come in there?
Yeah, I was just going to say that in the First World War throughout Munster, you tend to see that it's more urban centres that provide the most British Army recruits because due to food shortages, there's already plenty of work for farmers. And farmers' sons are thinking, I'm hanging around to get the farm. And it's generally the unemployed working class in a lot of cases who end up actually enlisting. And then when it comes to the War of Independence, of course, you have a lot of these soldiers ready and willing to take up arms again. Worth noting that there is recruitment after the First World War into the RIC. Cork men joined the Black Tans, joined the auxiliaries, although their numbers are obviously much smaller than, let's say, the British men who would join. But I think about 300 Cork men joined the Tans and the auxies post-war. But as well, we see that military experience going into the IRA and figures like Tom Barry that I'm sure we'll come to later.
Now, Eve, can I bring you in here? Because in 1920, then, there were local elections, right? And that gives you a more a granulated view of what's happening. What happened in the local elections in 1920?
There was two sets of elections. There was the urban elections in January 1920 and then the rural elections in June. And they'd introduced proportional representation in January on purpose to wrong foot the Republicans, the separatist movement, and to a certain extent it worked, but it kind of wrong footed the unionists as well. Like the results in Belfast were very interesting because Labour, Sinn Féin, and the Nationalists kind of out collectively had more representatives than unionists did, so it kind of undermined the unionist claim that they were speaking for all of Ulster when they were saying they were against United Ireland. But then the bigger elections were the rural elections in the summer of June, and Sinn Féin swept the board, right, everywhere outside of Ulster, and they were very important. And it was basically at that point that they took over local government. I mean, now Nationalists had kind of dominated local government in most of Ireland since the 1898 and the passing of the setting up of the local government legislation. I mean, in a lot of sense, a lot of what happened later was the result of that earlier legislation. But certainly, this, you know, at the time once they took over, particularly in terms of the kind of international credibility of the separatist movement, the fact that they had been able through an election to effectively take over local government was huge, you know, and it was and it established their credibility. And I think, you know, so in terms of what people were looking at the time, I think it was very important. And I in a way, there's the reason why we don't talk about it as much is because there's kind of an imbalance in the literature and in the research. You know, there's what I think since Arthur Mitchell's book on revolutionary government, 1995, I don't think there's been another book about, you know, the political side of the War of Independence, certainly like that. So I mean, to a certain extent, it's sources driven because we have so much material. Yeah.
Barry, you want to come in on that?
Yes. It's important to realize, Tommy, what Sinn Féin were actually trying to do. They were trying to set up a parallel administration.
An alternative,
absolutely, a counter state. And it was evident from the 1918 general election and the 1920 local elections that they did have the support of the people. And in the military context, what we're going to be talking about very shortly, any military organization that doesn't have the support of the people is doomed to fail.
Yeah. What about how prevalent, for example, were Dáil courts in Cork during this period?
No more than any other county, I would imagine. They did meet various places around the county, like in City Hall, for example, would be one meeting place where a number of arbitration cases were heard. So I don't think Cork would have had any particular claim to fame to have more than any other county.
Okay. So, but sounds to me, from what Eve's saying, the research hasn't really been done in this yet. So, I mean, there's obviously a story to be told there, or to be be winkled out more detail. Well, let's take that as a given, right? That because most of what we're going to talk about now will be on the military side, but I think we can take we can assume that this is the cutting edge of a much larger, counter-state effort.
Can I just say one thing, in case people don't know, the Dáil Éireann files for the first and the second Dáil Éireann are now freely available online via the Digital Repository of Ireland. That's DE2 and DE5.
Okay. Now, Pádraig, can I bring you in here? Because I want to talk about the military structures. How or when did, volunteer military structures begin to appear on the ground in Cork?
Well, the key thing about Cork is that because they haven't taken an active part, shall we say, in the Rising, the same leaders are still around afterwards. Those same structures are still in place. And Jerry mentioned there the surrender of arms. When arms were surrendered in Limerick City, it caused a split in the IRA, and the IRA in Limerick City were basically nullified for most of the War of Independence. And it led to this kind of internecine feud where even one IRA officer was shot as a result of it by his erstwhile comrades. But what happens in Cork is there isn't any such split. They kind of take that on the chin and they go on. And why some of the reasons why Cork is so prominent, one of them is it's a city as well and a county that has a strong trade union position. That's very important in terms of, let's say, military intelligence, moving around dispatches up and down to IRA headquarters in Dublin on the train. It's also a place that has a very strong old Fenian or Irish Republican Brotherhood network. And of course, the person who ends up in charge of that during the War of Independence is Michael Collins. And when the IRB have arms, Collins is very keen to get them back to his county men in County Cork. The other thing that's key to all of this really is personalities. Like, people will often say in the War of Independence, a county like Cork is very active because it has very suitable military terrain for guerrilla fighting. And somewhere like the Midlands, like Offaly, is very quiet because it's flat. But really, it comes down to nonsense. It comes down to leadership, because what you have is a county like Wicklow, which should be perfect for guerrilla warfare. And I think only 5 people are killed there in the entire War of Independence. But what you have in County Cork is you have leaders like McCurtain, McSweeney, who are driving from the very, very start, and they feel that they have to make up for 1916, for not being out and taking an active part.
Can I just come in there, just before we go on to the talk about the individuals, right? I just want to talk a little bit about the structures, right, of the volunteers. And one question that strikes me about this, why was the 1st Southern Division area so large, right? Because not only did it take in the county of Cork, but it took in County Waterford, Kerry, and West Limerick. I mean, it's a massive, massive area. Or does it just become large after the event? That's what I'm getting at. But it is a geographically the largest divisional area in the country, Jerry, isn't it? Have you any...
It is geographically, but I think, Tommy, the divisional structure was primarily a bit of a paper structure, really.
One thing,
it's very important to remember. When the Irish Volunteers were formed, they saw themselves as a fledgling army in a new Irish state. So they assumed the organization of a conventional military force. But after 1916, they quickly realized that conventional warfare against the British Army would not work. So while they kept the organization of a conventional military force, they assumed the tactics of guerrilla warfare.
So what was... Okay, let me reframe the question. What was the real structure of the IRA in terms of,
Pádraig,
you want to come back in?
Yeah, I was going to say, really, it's often brigade-based. You've three IRA brigades in Cork. You have the Cork No. 1 Brigade, which really is Cork City in the east of the county. You have Tom Barry's famous, and Liam Deasy's West Cork Brigade out as far as Skibbereen, Bandon, Panicuti. And then in North Cork, you have Liam Lynch and Sean Moylan. And they would be in areas like Kanturk, Mallow, and so on. And really what you have is the idea of a division is kind of imposed later in 1921 by IRA General Headquarters. And if you look at the areas in that 1st Southern Division, you're talking about Kerry, only parts of it are active. West Limerick is generally a very quiet military area. County Waterford, East Waterford, and West Waterford in particular is very quiet. And they do attempt once or twice to organise, Liam Lynch is in charge of this brigade, and they try to you know, kind of spread activity. There is, in mid May 1921, they attempt to shoot a number of British soldiers and off-duty troops all under one night throughout the 1st Southern Division. But really, there's one shooting in Limerick, and I think all the rest of them nearly happen in Cork. So the brigade, as Jerry said, is very much, or the division is very much a paper structure. It's the local brigades and the local leaders that are more important.
Eve, you want to come in first?
Well, no, I just wanted to say, I think the divisional structure was more of a thing during the Civil War, because it was more in place during the truce. And then go on.
Yeah. Andy, yeah.
Yeah, so I think this alternative state and the IRA emerges, but we also need to remember the old regime and the military structures that were there. But you've got to remember that Cork is one of the most important garrison counties in Ireland. It has a huge garrison presence, and this numbers 13,000 personnel by the end of the War of Independence. So,
is that total personnel, Andy, including Navy, by the way?
That excludes the navy and marines, and includes everyone else: Crown Forces, the police, auxiliaries, and so forth. So the important point here is that this is a hugely important in the whole social economy and the social landscape of the whole county. It's particularly centred in Cork and the harbour, and connected with that is a very substantial loyalist population, much larger than anywhere else. Mm. In the disturbed parts of the country, in the south and west, 10% of the population of the county is effectively Protestant. And much of that is loyalist. Not all, but quite the majority, shall we say.
And Andy, isn't it concentrated on the coast, essentially? So you're talking about a loyalist face, you know, with the hinterland essentially less...
I suppose the best way to look at it is the city, its hinterland, the harbour, and then a spur running off into West Cork, taking in Bandon and up the
along the coast,
the coast, yes, yeah, and it's very thin in North Cork. It's almost, you're down to 2%, very very little, you know. The British military complex and the naval complex is hugely important in the kind of, there's huge numbers of dependents, many Catholics as well, who are connected with this economically, so who are perhaps economically loyal, because they need to be to hold down their jobs. And this is the biggest source of income coming into the area. The biggest source of revenue from the British state, from London, coming into Ireland, is the military budget. Okay?
Right.
And in Cork, this is hugely important. And there's a lot of people living off this, Catholics and Protestants. And so this IRA is emerging alongside this old regime, so to speak. And that both sides are very strong. Both sides are very strong. The loyalist side is very strong, and the British military is very strong in Cork. So this is how the thing builds up.
Now, when does Cork... I'm contrasting this with the 2nd Southern Division, which is Tipperary, north of this region. Mm. They're active right from the get-go, right? Yeah. In 1919 into the summer. I know it doesn't really hot up till 1920. But when did things start getting active on the ground in Cork? Jerry, maybe, if you come in on that?
Yeah, well, I mean, even before the War of Independence, there was some volunteer activity. There was an ambush, I think, on the 8th of July. A couple of constables were shot down around Ballingarry. I mean, they survived. One man was wounded in the neck. If he had died, would we consider that the start of the War of Independence?
Okay, so they could have done their own solid bag.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, equally, on the 11th of November, they rescued Duncan McNeillis from the Cork Mail Prison, which was a spectacular operation, very well, highly organised. So it proved that the Cork Brigade was actually back in action. They had successfully reorganised by the 1916 Rising. Padraig mentioned the quality of the leadership, which was absolutely outstanding. But I think, Tommy, we should also look at the sinews of war. We looked at the organization. Let's drill down a bit and look at the equipment that they had. On one hand, we had the IRA, poorly trained, without a regular pay, without a barracks to go to, no uniform, poorly equipped with arms and ammunition on one hand, but equally highly motivated with good local knowledge, sound intelligence, and in the countryside, in particular, good knowledge of the terrain. Now, on the other side of the hill, look at their opponents. the Royal Irish Constabulary, an armed paramilitary force with barracks at the start of the war anyway, that covered almost every district in the city and town and parish in the county. Andy mentions the British Army, which again had barracks in Cork, Bandon, Kinsale, Bonavent, Mallow, Kilworth, various other places. And that's even before we get onto the Black and Tans and the auxiliaries. So, I mean, it was a very unevenly balanced. You had two military organizations. On one hand, the IRA. On the other hand, the Crown Forces, which at the start of the conflict was just the British Army and the RIC. Very unequal balance, but different in motivation and that type of thing.
Andy, can I bring you in here maybe just on, like, what for the, you know, the tactics and the strategy of the IRA? For example, how typically did they start military activity? You know, what sort of things did they do? I presume they would have tried to seize arms, that sort of thing.
Yeah,
maybe you can just expand on that.
Yeah, well, first of all, the term Tan War, which many veterans use, tells us a lot about the tactics. Essentially, it shows us they targeted the RIC. They were trying to get arms to start with. And basically, they were trying to make the old order ungovernable by attacking the RIC, both patrols, individuals, assassinating RIC men, and ultimately taking barracks by 1920. And gradually, police stations became targets for destruction, so that by the summer of 1920, perhaps half the RIC stations had been taken out of action. And of course, this freed up areas for the IRA in large swathes of rural Cork and across the rest of the country, indeed. And that was fatal for the British regime because they never recovered that ground. That was hugely important in terms of the advance of the IRA. Because of course, then that opened up country that the IRA could operate within. It could set up its courts and so forth. So they were also safe areas for moving people who were wounded or for flying columns and so forth. So this was hugely a hugely important advance that the British never reversed.
Eve, you wanted to come in on that?
Yeah, I did. Just to talk about a little bit about the tactics. I mean, see, in guerrilla war, you see, it's success in a military sense is less important than the political impact, you know, and so for instance, one of the most impactful actions of the IRA in the spring of 1920 was the burning of the barracks that Andy was talking about. Like they coordinated burning of our RIC barracks, and I think they attacked some of them as well, but mostly they burnt them in April 1920, and it was all across the country the same weekend, and it just really it had a huge impact in terms of the IRA's profile, you know. And so when they were carrying out attacks, it was more the way, and this will be important in terms of Kilmichael when we start to talk about that. It was more the wider impact that it had, and also when they started pulling out the RIC from the smaller barracks and things. The other thing that it did is that any kind of potential supporters that the British would have in terms of the local loyalist population, they suddenly felt very unprotected and much less likely to kind of support. They began to think, well, maybe we should just go with the way the wind seems to be blowing, you know. And they felt very betrayed from quite early on. So in all sorts of different ways, Britain is beginning to undermine its support base. Never mind the way they started to behave.
Pori, can I bring you in here? Because one of the controversial aspects of this was the targeting of off-duty British soldiers. And presumably there was a lot of them about the place because of what we previously said about the tradition of recruitment. Just talk to us about that a bit.
Yeah, there was. And this is kind of seen as being a breach of the rules of war at the time. The thing is that the rules of war, the Hague Convention, which was in place at the time, it doesn't really apply to Ireland because it doesn't prohibit attacks on off-duty troops, but it does rule out things like tricks, which is regarded as, you know, fighting without a uniform. But then the British say that it's illegal to even own a piece of the IRA uniform. And the Hague Convention as well also says that it doesn't apply to guerrilla wars and its conditions do not apply to militias. So really, you can forget about the international rules of war as they're set out. It doesn't apply to the Irish War of Independence. And both sides would breach what were considered the rules of war at the time. Key to the shooting of off-duty British soldiers is the treatment of Republicans captured by the British forces. For example, in April of 1921, members of the Essex Regiment and a British Army intelligence officer, Captain Cameron O'Connor Kelly, he's an Irishman, they capture two leading IRA officers in West Cork, Tom Hales and Pat Hart. And they're horrifically tortured. The torture scene in The Wind That Shakes the Barley is based on it, but a real event. Tom Hales survived this. Pat Hart is driven mad by it. And then shortly afterwards, in September of 1920,
that's a particular favourite, sorry, of my students, by the way, Padraig, that scene. Yeah. No, I used The Wind That Shakes the Barley by my students. I said, okay, avert your eyes at this stage. Right?
Yeah. The big error in that is the guy who was leading the torture and the interrogation was an Irishman, the British Army. But anyway, what you also get is in the same area in Bandon, John Connolly, who's an IRA officer, who's arrested by the British forces. He is killed and he's actually disappeared. His body is hidden in Lord Bandon's domain. And basically the IRA locally are very unhappy, obviously, understandably, about what's happening. They regard this as a breach of the rules of war. And in October of 1920, you have the Tureen ambush. This is Tom Barry's, you know, West Cork flying column fighting against the Essex Regiment, the same regiment that had been involved in this Tom Hales, Pat Hart torture thing. And basically, three Essex soldiers are killed in that ambush, and the remaining six are taken prisoner. And they're basically, their corporal is brought up, and he's told, listen, our guys have been killed in your custody, they've been tortured in your custody, we're going to obey the rules of war and let you go, but from here on out, you know, there's to be no more of this. And what happens that night is the Essex, of course, give assurances on the spot when the gun is to their head that they will obey this. But that night they go back and they run riot through the town of Bandon, attacking local homes and businesses, including Loyalist homes, by the way. And then this kind of continues that in January of 1921, because the mistreatment of prisoners is going on, Tom Barry issues an order that if you see a member of the Essex Regiment, whether they are on duty or off duty, you shoot them. You do not take them prisoner. You just execute them if they fall into your hands. Now, that is a breach of the rules of war. But what the British had been doing to captured IRA prisoners by killing them, summarily executing them, is also a breach of the rules of war. And this kind of snowballs very quickly, and it comes down to what regiment, what unit is captured. So in February of 1921, this West Cork flying column captures four members of the British forces in Bandon. Two of them are members of the Essex Regiment. Two of them are the Royal Marines. The two members of the Essex are executed, and the two Royal Marines are sent back with essentially a warning to the rest of to the other British forces. If you behave like the Essex, this is what will happen to you. We're letting you off because you're Royal Marines. And this spreads outside of Cork. It spreads to areas like Limerick. In January of 1921, the IRA in Limerick applied to IRA headquarters and say, we want the right to execute black and tans if we capture them. And you also have the 2nd Southern Division, Ernie O'Malley in Tipperary and in East Limerick. And he basically seems to issue an unofficial order saying, don't take tans as prisoners, just execute them. And it snowballs, it becomes really big. And by the end of the conflict, what you have is the British continue shooting prisoners. I think 17 Republicans and civilians are killed allegedly while trying to escape by the British forces. And it gets so bad that in June of 1921, an IRA volunteer called Patrick White is shot in custody by a British soldier. And the British soldier says at the inquest, yeah, I knew he wasn't trying to escape, but, you know, I just wanted to shoot him, so I shot him. And General Strickland, the British general in charge of Cork, wanted that soldier prosecuted for murder, which shows how bad things had gotten. But he was overruled by General Macready. And at the very end of the conflict in the truce, you have four unarmed soldiers, two members of the South Staffordshire Regiment, two members of the Royal Engineers, and they were taken out literally hours before the ceasefire came into effect, and they were executed while unarmed prisoners. But what is key to that is the guy who did the execution, Dan Halnan, was a very good friend and comrade of Dennis Spriggs, who was an IRA volunteer who'd been killed by the same regiment, the South Staffordshire, only the night before. So again, you have to look at the regiment, the people involved, but usually it's because of local factors on the ground that if a regiment was considered to have behaved badly, if the British in an area were executing prisoners, either officially or unofficially, the IRA basically said, the gloves are off, we're going to do the same thing.
Andy, can I bring you in here, right? Because I want to just pull back a minute just to look at the you know, a broad, a wide bore on this, right, in terms of overall casualty figures, because I want to move on in a minute to look at particular incidents. And before we get into the detail of that, and there are a few rabbit holes along the way, of course.
Sure.
You wanted to come back, first of all, on what Corey
could
was saying.
Could I just come back on the point that Porrick was making about retaliation? Because when British soldiers or police were killed, the British retaliated with unofficial reprisals in 1920 in particular. And this resulted in attacks in several towns in Fermoy, in Mallow, Cove, and Bandon, and finally in the major arson attack in Cork City in December 1920. So this did huge damage to property. And I think this was very significant in terms of the outcome of what happened. It put a lot of people out of work. Thousands of people were put out of work. And of course, Republican households were targeted for destruction also. So I think this strategy by the British did enormous damage in terms of the propaganda war. And that was very significant in terms of the final outcome of the settlement, I think, its impact in British public opinion, international public opinion. And I think that was very important because these attacks in Cork, they were all over the country, obviously, but there were some of the biggest ones were in County Cork.
Okay, Andy, I want to move on to, sorry, Eve, I just want to move on here because I want to just get an overall picture. Now, Cork accounted for the largest proportion of casualties in this conflict. How many? What percentage of the total killed in the War of Independence were in Cork?
Well, in the War of Independence, Cork would have had about 10% of the population of Ireland were in County Cork. Yeah,
right.
So the number killed, 530 to 540, roughly. The new research is coming out, and it seems to be going up, but that would be about 22 to 23% of the fatalities.
So it's over twice represented, if you like, pro rata.
Yes, it's far more violent than other counties. And
Eve, you want a quick comment? Sorry, just quick comment from Eve on that.
Yeah, no. I just say the Dead of the Irish Revolution is coming out in October. I've just got I helped them do the database, so I've actually got the figures here.
Good. Okay. For,
the Wi-Fi might have gone when the plug was gone in there, Eve. Anyway, we'll pick it up at the editing stage. Just give us that again.
Okay. No. So I don't think you will mind if I give the overall figures, but for their figures, overall figures between 1917 and December 21 is 2,351, and Cork is 549.
So that's almost equal to the people killed in Belfast in the pogroms, as they're called.
Yeah, and I mean, so the thing is, it depends on how you swing it. If you include 1916, then actually Dublin has by far the much higher casualty rate, but in terms of the War of Independence, it's certainly Cork and the general level.
What's the total for all Ireland there, Eve? The War of Independence.
You mean are you going from 1919? You mean
1919? Well, what do you have for 1919 to 21?
Well, I have for now, we're doing 1917 to 21, and it's only like there's not that many in it's just but for the earlier period, but we've got 2,351. But there's a lot of he'd be including like British soldiers who committed suicide or accidentally killed, you know, like the percentage of accidental deaths in among British soldiers, among the British Army in Ireland was really high.
So that's 23% that's coming out at.
Yeah, something so like
about,
that. I mean,
it's about the same.
Yeah, no, I mean, see, the thing is, there's always going to be a difference of a few, yeah, of course, you know. Yeah, some, yeah. So, and you just kind of work it out when you compare your, when people compare their notes. But it's something along that those lines, anyway.
Okay, Andy, going back to those figures, you're saying 500 plus right killed in Cork, right? Now, how many roughly of those could we say were informers or alleged informers?
Well, the number of suspected informers would be about over 70.
Okay, 70. And Pori, so, yeah.
So, carry on.
Yeah, I want to bring Pori again in that, because sometimes the implication is that these were just unfortunate people. I'm thinking of, Peter Hart's description of, you know, tramps, tinkers, etc., marginal people. We'll come back to that in a minute, right? But the implication in what Hart says is there really wasn't an issue for the IRA of informers, right? That seems to me the implication. Porrig, is that the case? I mean, did the IRA face a problem of British intelligence infiltration? And Gerry, maybe you can comment this as well, but Porrig, you first.
Yeah, well, anyone giving intelligence really is crucial, all this information in a guerrilla war for both sides. And the IRA at the time had very well-placed spies or sources, some of them inside British barracks, like Victoria Barracks in Cork. The British as well actually are probably most successful in Cork in infiltrating the IRA. Civilian informers maybe we'll deal with separately. But the British actually have some very good intelligence officers in Cork. Chief amongst them, I suppose, will be Captain Kelly, who I mentioned, who was involved in that torture. But you also have Bernard Law Montgomery, the famous hero of World War II, Monty, and you have Arthur Ernest Percival, who is the head of the, he's the chief intelligence officer for the Essex Regiment, later surrenders infamously Singapore to the Japanese in World War II. So you've got some quite good intelligence officers. And one thing Percival in particular manages to do is infiltrate the IRA with some recruits of his own, and so do the other officers. To give you some examples of these, Patrick Cruxy Connor is an ex-soldier from the Blarney area, quite a strong Republican area in just north of Cork City, and he had been in the British Machine Gun Corps in the First World War, and there was a famous ambush in February of 1921, the Coolnacottrock ambush. And him having the experience of being an ex-British soldier, he's put in charge of the key position, the machine gun, and of course he fails to operate it because he's been sent to join the IRA to get information to sabotage things by the British forces. And he's also responsible for the guns are moved from that ambush back into the Blarney Street area of Cork, and he gives information which leads to Kerry Pike, where six IRA volunteers are captured and again shot trying to escape. And that guy was paid £150 by the British forces, and he actually went to America. And in April of 1922, the IRA had tracked him down. He was shot in New York, but survived. And there's other examples of this. For example, in North Cork, you've William Bill Shields, an ex-soldier. And again, he is recruited by the British to infiltrate the IRA. He's responsible for a disaster for the IRA at Mourne Abbey. Six IRA dead as a result of that. He's responsible for a second incident at NAD, where another four IRA are killed. And even after he's been exposed as, the IRA becomes suspicious of him, they figure out he's responsible for this, he acts as an identifier. He goes around dressed in British Army uniform. He leads the British forces on their raiding parties, points out people, points out houses. He has key local information. And he also recruits other ex-soldiers who were subsequently shot by the IRA as spies. For example, Saunders and Begley in Cork City. And even in West Cork, which we think of Tom Barry's, group and that unit being, and Liam Deasy's unit being kind of, we think of civilian informers on the outside. But you have an ambush called the Upton ambush. It's on a train, and in Upton, and the IRA are attacking British troops that are on the train. And again, the key position is held by a guy called Patrick Coakley. And Coakley puts down his rifle, doesn't fight at all during the attack. And he later gives information to his Murrayat, taken prisoner by the British, but he's already working for them. And he actually reveals where the local IRA headquarters are. That's something that becomes very important later in the Cross Barry ambush. And he survived the truce. The IRA never caught up with him. And he actually came back to the area intermittently up until the 1960s. And there's another one I could go on, like John Madden, who's a section leader in Ballance little company. And when he's exposed by the IRA as a spy, he acts as a stool pigeon. He sits in amongst IRA prisoners who don't know him, and he says, "Oh, I've been picked up, lads. What's happening in your area?" And he gathers up information from prisoners and passes it back. So I would say the British have infiltrated the IRA more in Cork County than they have in other active counties, let's say Clare, Limerick, and so on.
Andy, what's your view on that?
Well, yeah, that's because British intelligence was quite successful in infiltrating the IRA. The IRA in Cork came down particularly heavily on informers and trying to sort of staunch that flow of information. But one of the tactics used were disappearances. 57% of the disappearances in Ireland were in County Cork. Well over half the disappearances in the whole country took place.
Can you define that, Andy? Just define that for listeners. What do you mean by a disappearance?
Well,
the body is never found.
The body was secretly buried, so that it was never found.
What's the logic of that? One would presume that if you kill an informer, you want to make an example of them, right?
Well, that's
disappear them.
Sure. Yeah. So that's one way where that the bodies were labeled and left in the street, and then that went into the newspapers. It was a kind of form of terror, if you like. Disappearances had another logic. Disappearances frequently occurred if they wanted to question someone in the first instance for some time and hold them, and secondly, it prevented reprisals on any given area because they didn't know where these
people
were.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So, Jerry, you want to come in on that?
Yeah. I just wanted to put the whole thing into context because I know a lot of ink has been spilled discussing the morality of different things that happened in Cork. And just like I said, to put the whole thing into context, intelligence, as Padraig said, was essential. Is essential in any military conflict. And for the IRA, it was simple. The more intelligence the British got, the more men they lost. So they had a commander had a choice. If he identified an informer, he could do nothing, or perhaps even warn him, or he could execute him. I mean, potentially, it's possible that innocent people would have been killed, but this was a war. I know the British government decided to, or tactfully labeled it a police action, but what was actually being fought was a war from both sides. And sometimes, unfortunately, when you unleash the dogs of war, many unfortunate things happen. And like I said, in the context of a local IRA commander, his main responsibility was to keep his men alive. And if he identified a source that was getting him killed, he really would have had no other option, only to eliminate it.
Now, talking about the reality of war, Eva, I want to bring you in here on this because it's Kilmichael. We can't get away from Kilmichael. I tell you, I'm going to ask you an obvious question, first of all, Eve. What happened at Kilmichael? Because sometimes people have discussions about this and don't even know what the original incident. Just give us a very brief, I'm talking a very, very broad brush stroke. What did this ambush amount to?
Well, it was basically an ambush of a patrol of 18 auxiliary, well, 17 auxiliaries and one black and tan who was just along for the ride, and they were basically wiped out in the ambush. There was one guy survived, one guy kind of got away briefly, but was later killed by I think it was probably the next day by a different unit. And I guess why it's controversial, I suppose, because the casualties were so high, and it's been questioned why they didn't try and take prisoners. And so, I mean, in a nutshell, that's it. But I mean, it was extraordinary. The timing of it happened like just 7 days after Bloody Sunday, and it scared the bejesus out of the British government because it was. You know, quite a well-organized military action, and it was basically the incident that prompted their decision to introduce martial law.
Now just to clarify something here, I mean, obviously Tom Barry was the leader, right? But Barry led from the front. I mean, Barry had to walk out into the middle of the road, toss in a grenade. You know, I mean, pretty outdated stuff.
Well, I mean,
whatever you think of Tom Barry, you know.
Yeah, no. It was if you're going to look at ambushes in that way, it was, you know, it was some outcome. I mean, the thing is, the important thing to remember is we're never going to know exactly what happens. All right.
Before we go into what happened, Jerry, can I bring you in here? You're the guy with the professional army background.
Yeah.
As an exercise, a military exercise, how good, you know, or how bad was Kilmichael as a piece of military, you know, military action planning and so on?
If you judge it from its success, it worked. I mean, the enemy mobile patrol was effectively eliminated. Looking at various elements regarding the classic ambush, he did occupy key terrain. The deployment is some bit questionable. I mean, could have been what we call today a blue on blue from guys opposite side of the road. Barry's own command and control, where he positioned himself, he couldn't really exercise effective command and control, you know, for over the whole thing. But when you're talking about Kilmichael, I think we focus too much on the personality of Tom Barry. Mm. As important as the commander was, it's important to remember there was over 30 other volunteers who took part in the Kilmichael ambush. I mean, and you look at it from their perspective, and I know, again, we could spend hours debating what did or didn't happen, but from the human side, the minute the shooting starts, men are afraid. Adrenaline is pumping through there. Yeah. You know, nobody knows what's going to happen. And sometimes, you know, there's an old military saying, no plan survives first contact. And I'm sure many of these...
Or as Mike Tyson says, no plan survives a punch in the face.
Yeah. There you go. many of these operations develop a life of their own as they go along. But I think Eve made a very good point. Kilmichael was what we would call today a spectacular. It rocked the British military and political establishment. And more importantly, it was the aftermath, because it led to the introduction of martial law.
Just before you go on to that, right? Am I right in observing the original shots of Kilmichael would have been from a distance, but when it got going, this was close hand-to-hand combat.
Absolutely, it was very close forward combat.
Now, I want to just, we could spend a whole head school on this one. Eve, the whole thing of the false surrender. I mean, just so the big controversy is that Barry says that some of the Oxys, after they surrendered, opened up again, and then he said, kill them all, right?
Yeah.
Whereas other people say that there was no false surrender, that Barry just had them killed in cold blood. I mean, where is the jury on this one at this stage?
Well, I mean...
Is there a matter of opinion at the end of the day, then? It seems to me. I mean, by the way, we've had more copy in this in History Island over the years than any other issue. You know what I'm saying?
See, the thing is, well, first of all, I just want to just make one more point. The British were embarrassed by Kilmichael, all right? They were embarrassed. One of their crack counterinsurgency unit just got hammered, you know, just got wiped out. And they were so they didn't get a state funeral, for instance, the way that the Bloody Sunday guys had the week before. So in all sorts of ways, they approached it differently. Yeah. But in terms of, the false surrender, the thing is that's something that Tom Barry says in 1949. That's not what he says earlier. And this is, I don't want to go into the him and the hunter. He actually did.
No spoilers, please, for your book.
But I mean, he wasn't like, you know, he did actually change his story. Right. And there's more and more evidence coming out about that. I'm not even sure. It's not even clear that he was the first person to talk about a false surrender. I think in the 30s.
So can I come across here?
Another group of veterans said that the false surrender, the way Tom Barry tells in 49, did not happen. And we're never going to know for sure. It's just, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, and I suppose the other thing is for listeners, right, is that it's a very good exercise in what is or isn't evidence, and in particular the use of oral evidence, because oral evidence given over a long period of time, you know, it becomes contaminated, for want of a better word. Now, I'm going to cut across here and say, I'll throw this out maybe to Jerry or to Porrig. Does it matter whether it's a false surrender or not? I mean, we're talking here about a really vicious hand-to-hand thing. People are going to do anything. Jerry, you...
Absolutely. Again. Look, Tommy, I think the false surrender has occupied people's minds too much, to be quite frank with you.
Yeah.
The main thing about Kilmichael was that it was, from the IRA perspective, it was a spectacular success. And heretofore, the British always referred to the IRA as the murder gang. Criminals, murderers, killers. But with the introduction of martial law that came as a result of Michael Ambush, de facto, they were no recognizing the Irish Republican Army as a military opponent. That's the important thing.
Pádraig, you want to come in there?
Yeah, I was going to say, just echoing what Gerry said there, there's actually a phrase, I think it's by one of the British government's advisors. He quotes Lloyd George commenting on Kilmichael, saying, "The other attacks were the actions of a murder gang. This last one was a military operation." Again, are we ever going to know for certain was there a false surrender or not? Like, it's, as Gerry said, nothing survives first contact. There's people dying at a rate of, you know, one every 20 seconds in this thing, if you believe the standard narrative of the ambush. And the idea that all the British are able to get together, all the Aussies behind the lorry, and say, "I say, chaps, will we surrender to Paddy?" You know, they're not in a position to have this. And there's things like Barry says he sees one of the auxiliaries throw his gun to the ground, and he considers that part of the surrender. He threw his rifle away. Maybe his rifle bolt was stuck and he was reaching for his pistol. But the important thing I would say about Kilmichael is, just to look at it in a broader context, you do have British accounts of, or accounts from people on the British side of a false surrender. Lionel Curtis, who's a British civil servant, and again, he's one of their top guys, says in June of 1921 that there had been a false surrender. Frederick Crozier, the former head of the auxiliaries, says it. But what I would say is, if you look at other IRA ambushes outside of Cork, the Scrimmog ambush in Roscommon, the IRA veterans there all come out and say, "Yeah, we captured two tans and we took them and we shot them, we executed them." And the same thing at Drumkeen in Limerick. Drumkeen, the IRA say, "Yeah, we captured two tans, took them out. One of the guys begged for his life, but nah, we just shot him. He was a tan."
Okay, so it's not unusual for prisoners to be shot.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I come in there for
Andy in here, yeah.
So in terms of Kilmichael, the issue of surprise was absolutely central and important, and it was a classic element of surprise. But the preparation was very careful. There was a certain amount of luck, you'd have to say, but the Oxys were particularly slow to respond. And the research on the other boys of Kilmichael, the auxiliaries, that has been done by Nelson, reveals that actually a lot of them lacked combat experience. They had a reputation of being a crack force, but actually in reality, quite a lot of them came out of the Air Force, the Navy. Okay. They didn't have combat experience, so they didn't actually respond very well to the initial attack.
Okay, actually,
Eve, yeah.
Yeah, I have 2 points to make. First of all, they joined, most of them joined the Air Force after having been in the Army. So all but one of them did have combat experience. So that's actually not quite true. And on Pádraig's point about the capture report and Lionel Curtis and all that, and he does say that, but what they were going on was the version of events that was in the captured report that's in the record of the rebellion in Ireland, and that basically after an auxiliary they thought was dead shot one of the volunteers, that's the decision that they wiped everybody out. That's not what is said in Guerrilla Days in Ireland. So it's not really the same. You know what I mean? People are kind of conflating two different.
Yeah, but then, Eve, just to be fair to Tom Barry is writing a kind of an adventure story. He's not writing a Quentin Tarantino script.
Well, Tom Barry in some ways was kind of his own worst enemy, because he was a terrible man for putting himself in the center of things and leaving other people out. And there's legions of evidence of, you know, from all over the place to show that. And so the thing is, anyway, that's enough.
Now, can I tell you what, I'm just looking at the time here, right? I want to move on, because the other big military event, of course, was the Cross Barry. Maybe, Gerry, if you could just come in again in 2 minutes. What happened at Cross Barry? Because what happened first of all?
Well, there was a huge
our friend Percival, of course, involved in this one.
What we would call today a cordon and search operation went into West Cork to capture what they thought would be the headquarters of the 3rd West Cork Brigade. And I know
that's Barry's brigade.
Well, Barry would be part of that organization, yeah. And I know what we would, it's been known as the Cross Barry Ambush, but I would probably call it the Battle of Cross Barry. It was more of a successful withdrawal out of the fighting withdrawal from to escape the coordinate search, as opposed to a classic ambush in the Kilmichael sense. But again, it was a startling success for the IRA that they could manage to evade that. And it's at the same
time. Just stop you there, Jerry. Just stop you there from a military point of view, because okay. The thing is, setting up an ambush is relatively straightforward. Well, yeah. Famous last words. Yeah. Said he with no military experience whatsoever, yeah. Right? Because you can control 90% of the what's in front of you, right? Escaping encirclement, as Barry did, that's a different story altogether. That's thinking on the hoof. That's
what I was saying. It's more of a battle, I would call it. And you look, and again, how effective the British were at putting the cordon in place is also open to question. But we could debate that for endlessly. But the critical thing here is the outcome. And Barry and over 100 of his men successfully escaped. I mean, if they were captured, it would have been a huge success for the British military at the time.
Just give me that again. Barry had 100 men. Now, that's a large formation for the IRA.
It's pretty large. Like I said, if those guys had been captured or a portion of them killed, it would have been a major blow for the West Cork Brigade and equally a major success for the Crown Forces.
Paul, you want to come in on that?
Come in there. Yeah, just on the point of information, you talked there, Tommy, about setting up an ambush versus escaping encirclement. The original ambush wasn't actually planned for Cross Barry. The Essex Regiment, who were the main unit involved, they took the fight to the IRA. They got rid of their uniform trousers, went into shorts, changed their studded boots for rubber boots. They were able to move around quietly through the countryside. And what the IRA had noticed was that they would be fed at mobile kitchens. One of these set up at a place called Shipool, about halfway between Inishannon and Kinsale. The IRA laid a trap for them there, an ambush. But again, the IRA position was, here comes intelligence again, noted by a civilian informer who told the British. The British start to mobilise very large forces from Macroom, from Bandon, from Cork, and from Kinsale. But the IRA, again, here comes intelligence. There was a carpenter working in Charles Fort in Kinsale, a volunteer by the name of Patrick Pierce. He sees the mobilisation. He hears talk of what's happening. He gets the word out to the IRA. The IRA move from Shipool north towards Cross Barry. As they are coming northwards, they're spotted by a British Army plane. This sees the direction that they're travelling. And again, here comes the third intelligence aspect in this. Patrick Coakley, the guy I mentioned at the Upton ambush, the guy who had infiltrated the IRA, has told the British forces that the local IRA headquarters is somewhere in Ballymurphy, north of Cross Barry. So the British are heading for that area. That's where they think the IRA are going. And the IRA then, 103 of them, set up their kind of defensive position. The reason why it comes down to geography that the IRA escaped, the auxiliaries from Macroom confused. There's a lot of places with Cross in the place name, Cross Nolanov, Cross Mahon, and Cross Barry. And the British, actually, the auxiliaries from Macroom don't actually go to Cross Barry. They go to another place named Cross, and that leaves a gap which allows the IRA to escape. In terms of numbers, it's certainly the largest engagement in the
Paul, can I just cross you there? I mean, they didn't just escape through a gap. They had to. They attacked.
Fighting withdrawal.
A formation.
Yeah, a fighting withdrawal. And what I'd say is Tom Barry claims that there were 30 enemy killed, and local people will still tell you that. That's not true. It's very easy. Like, if you go on the Cork Fatalities Register, which Andy has put together, you can identify all the people killed. 10 members of the Essex Regiment, 1 black and tan, so that's 11 combined British casualties, versus 3 IRA volunteers are killed. And interestingly, actually, one of the IRA volunteers who's killed is a guy called Peter Monaghan. He was actually a Scottish soldier who had defected from the British Army and joined the IRA. And there's a number of interesting cases like that throughout Ireland we don't have time to go into here. But what Tom Barry says is that his 103 men were facing off 1,500 British troops. Now, other IRA volunteers come along, guys like Flor Begley, and say, no, Barry's exaggerating. Maximum, we were facing 500. But even at 5-1 odds, and think of what Jerry talked about, the armament, the training of the IRA as amateur volunteer guerrilla fighters compared to British forces, that's an amazing success to engage the British, to hit them with 11 fatalities and successfully withdraw from the area. But I would say that if you look at Kilmichael, it's 17 British killed, but 3 IRA fatalities. If you look at Cross Barry, it's 11 British forces killed, 3 IRA fatalities. The largest and most successful operation, well, the successful in terms of the achievement, doesn't happen in Cork at all, even though we think of Cork as the key place. It happens in Limerick. In the Drumkeen ambush, the IRA's East Limerick Brigade inflict the same number of casualties as Cross Barry, 11 British killed, and the only injury the IRA have is one of their guys is wounded by losing a finger. So the fact that in other ambushes the IRA get away without any fatalities means sometimes they can be more successful. But again, if you engage in anything like this, you're going to need to be prepared to lose your men as well.
Eve, you wanted to come in?
Well, no, I just wanted to come in because the thing is having survived the Great War and on the Western Front doesn't necessarily give you the skills that you need to fight a guerrilla war. Yeah. I mean, it's quite a different sort of fighting. And so in some ways, you know, if they had gotten British soldiers who were veterans of the Boer War, you know, or the pre-war army, and much more used to dealing with kind of small wars, which Britain did a lot of, they would have had a more suitable set of skills, but the British armies were starting to develop those sorts of tactics, right? And so that's why the British army was so angry when the truce was called, because they thought they were winning as far as they're concerned, and they've been stabbed in the back. But
Very briefly, Tommy, just 2 points.
Jerry, first, then I'll come back to Andy.
Sorry, Andy. I think it's we shouldn't fall into the trap of the Americans did in Vietnam about the body count. While casualties are important, I think the more significant thing was the actual outcome, the political and military outcome of these operations conducted by either the British or the IRA. I mean, a defeat for the IRA would say that such as it happened at Clonmult would have a huge impact on their morale. And vice versa. Like Eve mentioned, the impact of the Kilmichael ambush. You know, that it's the impact politically and militarily, even amongst the local population, that are equally more important. The IRA were never going to beat the British Army in conventional warfare. That's a fact. They had to win a moral victory. And I would argue that's what they've done. And sorry, just to top up what Eve was saying, again, by 1921, the British actually were adopting, changing their tactics. Patrick mentioned aircraft. They were using aircraft to spot IRA columns on the move. And they also had formed their own flying columns that were conducting mobile patrols to the countryside. And that was proving effective.
Andy, you wanted to come in there?
Yeah, I think the important point is that from the British perspective, they left things for too long in the hands of the police, their counterinsurgency strategy. And they really only gave control to the army after the establishment of martial law. And so then they had very little time left. So effectively, time ran out. The army was just getting into its stride by the summer of 1921. And then it was too late. The game was up and that they'd lost the propaganda war at that stage.
Eve, yeah.
Yeah, no, just to come in, the other important point is that the British were in terms of unofficial reprisals, particularly over 1920, not only were they basically encouraging the police to just shoot as many IRA men as they could and attack and burn creameries, that then Hammer Greenwood was standing up in the House of Commons and lying about it. I mean, there was a sustained campaign of public lying. The thing is, there was, you know, Ireland was full of British journalists who were basically reporting on this, and also the Labour Party sent over a commission to investigate what was happening, and basically the British policy was discredited in the eyes of you know, huge swathes of the British population, certainly by the truth. And that I think people don't give enough credit to the role of the British Labour Party and the British press for exposing the excesses of the behavior of Crown forces and exposing the lies of their own government, because it was very important.
Okay, guys, I'm just looking at the time here, right? And I just need to be heading towards wrapping up here. Jerry, can I go to you? You've touched on this a little bit already, right? But could you just give us an outline? What was the military situation on the ground at the time of the truce? Because that's where we're going to finish this discussion.
Okay, Tommy, like I said, the British had changed their tactics. They did have a number of spectacular successes in Cork in 1921, the Gypsy ambush, the Clonmult ambush, the Mourne Abbey ambush. The executions had been introduced, and 13 members of the IRA had been executed in Victoria Barracks. I think 11 of those were, 10 or 11 were from Cork units.
13, Jerry. 13 out of 24.
No, there were 13, but I think, no, but I'm not... they weren't all from the Cork Brigade. I think there were two from Limerick, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, yeah, that's right? True. Yes.
So, I mean, 11 of those were actually from the Cork Brigades. And there were others awaiting trial and potential execution. The prisons were full. So from the British perspective, I mean, General Strickland said when he received his orders to evacuate on Victoria Barracks, what was it all for? 2 months more and we had him, right? No, I think that's probably an opinion shared by many of the leadership of the IRA in Dublin. Like, how long more could they sustain this? The city of Cork was ruined. The jails were full. The British were getting the upper hand. No, they didn't, like I said, inflict a military defeat on the IRA. And equally, the IRA didn't inflict a military defeat on the British Army. But I would argue that they won a moral victory and that they forced the British government finally to sit down around the negotiating table with people who a short time previously they considered to be murderers.
Barry, can I just come in there, though? Would there have been many in the IRA, though, who thought they'd won more than a moral victory?
Well,
like, this is with an eye to the Civil War later.
Yeah.
So what was the...
And this was the problem. I mean, when the truce is declared, what was the war aims of the IRA? The formation of an independent 32-county republic. And again, this is all the type of thing that leads to the Civil War. I mean, there were arguments. Had we won, what did we win? You know?
Yeah.
What did we go to war for? Why were there so many people killed? And I know that's a story for another day, but the fact that we're ending here in the truce, neither side had won a victory, and I won't say neither side a military victory, neither side were defeated. But I would definitely say the Republican movement had won a moral victory in the eyes of the world. Eve mentioned the American Commission, the British Labour Commission. They all were damning indictments on British policy in Ireland.
Now, just, Padraig, I'm going to go to you next, but I just want to go back to the title of this hedge school, which is Cork Crucible of the War of Independence. Does it deserve that description, in your opinion?
In the very early days of the conflict, you often have more activity in other counties like Tipperary, Clare, although parts of West Cork around Aries are very active as well. Really what I would say is Cork often sets the trend in terms of things like the number of spies killed per or alleged spies killed per county. That's really a massive phenomenon in Cork that you know, the rest of the country pales in comparison. Things like I talked about there, the execution of off-duty troops, that's something, again, that develops in Cork and is adopted and spreads to other areas. In terms of the British changing their tactics, we talked about the Essex Regiment having their own flying and mobile columns, you know, big developments like that in Cork. A lot of executions in Cork as well. The British were trying out that policy there. But what I'd say, going back to kind of sum it up, you know, who was winning, what was happening at the time of the truce, the British had been saying for 6 or 7 months prior to the truce, just give us another week, don't negotiate with the IRA, we'll win. And Montgomery and Percival have a correspondence afterwards. And Montgomery, I think, says that, you know, we could have settled this, you know, Cromwell or the Hun, meaning the Germans, could have settled this in a very short time. If we could use Cromwellian methods, of course we would have won. But the problem is it would only quiet down for a time and it would rise up again. And most importantly, these methods were not acceptable to the ordinary British public and to the wider world, because Ireland was front page news at the time. And I think the IRA in Cork and in Munster and in parts of the West, which were becoming more active, were still in quite a strong position despite the losses and setbacks. They were still there in the field as a fighting force. The area where the IRA was weakest at the time of the truce was in Dublin City. We often hear that the IRA only had ammunition for 2 weeks left. That is the IRA in Dublin. And the reason for that is the disastrous IRA attack in terms of men and material losses on the customs house in May of 1921. But again,
good propaganda, though. You know, going back to Jerry's point, it's not just the short-term military thing. I mean, De Valera, who promoted that, would argue that even though it was a military disaster, it fulfilled its political purpose.
It is. It's De Valera promotes it, but it's also approved by Collins and others. But the thing is that IRA GHQ and Richard Mulcahy, who's the commander-in-chief of the IRA at the time, he issues memos saying that Dublin is key. We have to hold Dublin. If we lose the capital, everything else is lost. And it is that attack which breaks the Dublin IRA, while the other IRA in other areas is either still able to keep the field or is becoming more active in areas that it hadn't been active previously.
Eve,
I just say, I mean, certainly in the Mulcahy papers, if you look at what when he was kind of writing things down and strategizing, he did see Cork very much as being the crucible of the war and where the IRA was the best organized. I mean, I'm not sure I 100% agree with Porg about the IRA in Cork. I mean, in general, I do, but I think that they were certainly still in the field. But I actually think that, as far as I know, that they've broken up a lot of the brigade flying columns, or they got and people had returned to their about battalion areas, and they were just carrying out local attacks because of the British counterinsurgency was getting more effective, so that they were still in the field, all right. And they were always much better organized than other areas, but they were they were getting weaker, I think. You know, whether they were weak at Dublin is a different question.
Yeah, certainly by the end of the conflict, they're not able to capture barracks and things that they had done previously, and the British are much more concentrated. But again, it's, you know, how do you measure success? They're still in the field. Yeah. The British have promised to get murdered by the throat, and they haven't.
Yeah, Andy, you want to come in there? I'll go to you, Dan, Jerry.
In my view, the reason why it was a crucible was because a very significant share of the property destroyed by Crown forces in Ireland in the year 1920, were in Cork. Some of the critical Crown Force urban attacks in 1920 in response to IRA assassinations took place in Cork. And the negative fallout from those events, from a propaganda perspective, in my view, were more centrally important to the political settlement of the conflict ultimately than either Crossbarry or Kilmichael.
Jerry, I want to go to you just to wrap up here, right? Because the last Hedge School we did was about Derry, the Northwest, including Donegal. And the figures for Donegal were about like 12 people killed in the conflict, very, very small. And that was in that discussion, it was contrasted with Cork. But the implication was that people in Cork had some sort of a bloodlust, right? So my final question here is, this gets to the nub of it, right? Because we there's no argument that Cork saw the most fatalities. Yep. My question is this something to be proud of, or is this something to be ashamed of?
I think you have to look at this in context, Tommy, and I think Parry touched on it earlier on. The failure of the Easter Rising, the failure of the Cork Brigade to participate in the Easter Rising was a huge psychological blow in the minds of the Cork volunteers. Shortly before Terence McSweeney died on his hunger strike, which we never touched on, or the death of McCurtain, right? Shortly before he died, he wrote a letter to Cathal Brua. Included in that letter was the sentence, "Ah, Cathal, the pain of Easter is dead at last." And I think that sums it up. And when you look at, just following up from Andy's perspective, if you look at McSweeney's own philosophy, it's not those who can inflict the most, but those who can suffer the most will endure. That's exactly what happened in Cork.
I tell you,
were hammered, but they won a moral victory at the end.
Jerry, I'm going to wrap it up there because you've teed up the next Hedge School very nicely, which will be on Terence McSweeney, martyrdom, civil resistance, and the Irish Revolution. And by the way, Eve, this will address the issue you raised, because we broadened the scope of this one here to look at civil resistance in the Irish Revolution. So that's going to be discussed at the next Hedge School, which will be on our website in August. But listen, I think we've certainly tackled the situation of Cork from many, many different angles. So I'd like to thank our panel, Eve Morrison, Andy Bielenberg, Porrig Óg O'Rourke, and Jerry White. And thank you, the listeners, for tuning in. And I'll hope you'll be with us for our next Hedge School. Thank you very much.